Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Haunted by Waters, introducing today's show with a view from South Africa on a $3.75 billion US dollar World Bank loan about to be presented to South Africa's Electricity Supply Commission to build new coal-fired power stations. We look at the impact on carbon emissions, climate change, and our human environment. This show was recorded during an online seminar discussion with participants from Calcutta, Nashville, Cape Town, and based at the Center for Civil Society at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban, South Africa. We will hear from writer David Howers, community organizer Desmond Dessa of South Durban Community Environmental Alliance, and Trevor, chair of the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee, who was also involved in the World Bank bonds boycott. The seminar is moderated by Professor Patrick Bond at the university and the director of the Center for Civil Society. David Howers is the author of a recent report, The World Bank and Eskom, Banking on Climate Destruction, in which he discusses the $3.75 billion World Bank loan to South African parastatal electrical power supplier Eskom and the irony inherent in the bank's central mission of alleviating poverty. You can download the free report from Groundwork's website, which is www.groundwork.co.za. David Howers is the first of four presenters aired here today, and he gives an overview of the issues involved in coal-fired power.
This report was brought out about halfway through last year, and there's been quite a lot of water under the bridge since then. Notably, the deal has been concluded, although not approved by the bank board. So we now know that the deal is for $3.75 billion with the bulk, I think about $2 billion going to Medupi, which is a very large coal-fired power station, about half a billion going to coal infrastructure, particularly railing in coal to some of Eskom's stranded existing power stations. And there's a kind of fig leaf of $250 million for renewables. The renewable projects, by the way, are under a delay at the moment because Eskom doesn't actually have the cash to put them on the front burner. And Eskom would, in fact, like to palm them off on an independent power producer. So that's broadly the shape of the thing. The justifications made for the loan are essentially that it'll help deal with poverty in South Africa, that it will put South Africa onto a low-carbon growth path. Most people know the bank and its central mission statement, which is alleviating poverty. I don't think anybody who's had close dealings with a bank imagines that to be remotely true. The only way in which it can claim to alleviate poverty is through economic growth, which is basically the central ideology of capital. If we promote economic growth sufficiently, we will get enough people into work, and that will be the process by which we alleviate poverty. In fact, over the last two or three decades, there's been a situation where the alleviation of poverty at the bottom has seemed to be dependent on a vast expansion of wealth at the top, because that is the basis of economic growth. So it's been accompanied by expanded inequality, and in the process, those who are brought in from the bottom, as in China, may be better off in money terms, but are arguably worse off in terms of the amenities to which they have access, the natural resources to which they have access, starting with land, etc., etc. So that strategy has not been convincing for at least two decades, and it's getting ever less convincing. The other point that the World Bank constantly makes is access to modern energy for the poor. Access to modern energy means electricity, gas, or petrol, essentially, for transport. The problem with this is that all the World Bank's projects, possibly with one or two minute exceptions, are designed to get the energy out. That's particularly notable in the case of petrochemicals, oil. And in South Africa, with this particular program, what is actually happening is that it isn't actually the energy that's going out, it's the base metals and base chemicals that are produced using those energies. So essentially, we export a great deal of energy every time we send out a bar of aluminium. South Africa did pretty well with the electrification program comparative to other countries through the 90s. I think we went up from about 30% to about 70% of people with access to electricity. Now, access to electricity doesn't actually mean that you get the electricity, of course. It simply means that there's a meter that you have to feed constantly in your front room, and when you run out of money, well, you run out of electricity too. We went into a major slump last year. The great and the good, or at least the great anyway, are telling us that that we're going to be back on track with economic growth pretty damn soon. So hold tight, folks. There's not too much to worry about. There are serious questions around that. Part of those questions relate to the fact that the response to the burst bubble has been to reinflate the bubble, which is still leaking out the other end, but never mind that. The other problem with it, which specifically relates to energy, is peak oil. Now, whether or not you actually believe the thesis of peak oil, I presume everybody here is more or less familiar with it. Everybody in the energy industry is anticipating a big energy crunch in this decade. That is because the investments to boost energy supply to what the International Energy Agency says that we're going to need simply have not been made, partly because the recession pulled the plug on them, and partly because they weren't actually getting made even when the commodity boom was in full flight before the middle of 2008. So there ain't going to be enough oil to go around. Now, arguably, there hasn't been for a little while. In about 2004 or 5, the IEA was projecting 120 million barrels of oil a day on average by 2020. That got revised down quite radically in the next few years to about 105, and the driver of that was price. Somebody was being cut off, in other words, from modern energy. And we can look forward to a lot more of that in the next decade. Along with that, should the green shoots of global growth start getting going again, well, they're going to be strangled by an absence of energy. In taking on this debt, which is guaranteed by Treasury, what Treasury is doing is making two bets. One is that economic growth is going to justify the debt in the first place and create the revenues whereby it can be paid back. The second bet that it's making is that the rand is going to hold its value against the dollar. The loan is made in dollar terms, so if the rand heads south, which it's done repeatedly, then we are caught in more or less exactly the same debt trap that that countries were caught in during the 80s, when they had accumulated lots of debts on the back of the oil crisis and the commodity boom of the late 70s. And come the 80s, Reagan hoisted interest rates. Well, actually, Carter started the process, but in the process precipitated a recession, which took the ground from under oil and other commodity exports on the one hand, so third world countries were not getting their exports, and on the other hand, ramped up their debt repayments. So they were caught both sides. So that's the other bet that the Treasury is making.
You're listening to David Howers, the author of the recent report, The World Bank and ESKOM, Banking on Climate Destruction, and this is Raising Sand Radio at Stanford University's KZSU FM 90.1. I'm Susan Gallimore. You can email me at susan@raisingsandradio.org. And let's go back to David Howers and learn how all of this relates to carbon emissions.
There's nothing low carbon about this. The World Bank loan specifically goes for Medupi, but it does have the broader process of supporting ESKOM's broader new build process. The new build process is centered on two vast power stations. They are respectively the fourth and the fifth biggest in the world, Kusile and Medupi. There was a third one. ESKOM's official position is that although they can't afford to build it, if they don't build it, that capacity is going to have to be built by the private sector. The World Bank's justifications for proclaiming the towards low carbon trajectory on this is that Medupi and Kusile are both supercritical plants. That means that instead of getting 35% efficiency on the conversion from coal to electricity, that's the amount of energy embodied in the coal converted into electricity, you only get 35% out on a conventional coal-fired power station. A supercritical power station takes that to a whopping 40%. So you lose 60% of the energy in coal. That's the one defense of it. The second defense of it is that, they've kind of insisted on scrubbers being put in on these plants. Medupi was going to be built without scrubbers. This was because, in the opinion of previous CEO, Jacob Morocco, Lephalale, the area where it's being built, is just up there on the border of Botswana and Limpopo. Isn't really polluted enough yet, so that one could go ahead without scrubbers. Kusile, on the other hand, was to be built with scrubbers. The last prices that we have come across is $124 billion for Medupi. It's slightly smaller than Kusile. It's not clear at the moment whether that includes the cost of the scrubbers. Scrubbers are expensive. The cost on Kusile is put at $140 billion now. 3 years ago, the respective estimated prices on those two plants was $76 billion for Medupi and $80 billion for Kusile. So you see there's been a whopping escalation in prices, and we have not heard the end of that yet.
If you're just tuning in, this is Raising Sand Radio on KZSU FM 90.1, Stanford University, and we're listening to David Howers on the World Bank's $3.75 billion loan to South Africa's electricity supplier Eskom to build new power stations supposedly with low carbon footprint. David Howers is author of the recent report, The World Bank and ESKOM, Banking on Climate Destruction, and you can download that free report at groundwork.co.za.
Assuming that the capacity is built, pretty much double carbon emissions from the power system by round about 2020. The emissions don't stop there, of course. Our power stations are incredibly pollution intensive. I have given figures in this paper for what they have been producing, burning in terms of coal, their carbon dioxide emissions, and then their sulfur nitrogen particulates emissions. They're not nice things to live next to. And ESKOM's traditional way of dealing with this is to build enormously high stacks. The logic behind that is that you simply disperse the pollution further, yeah? So instead of the pollution being concentrated around the plant itself, for most of the high-fire plant, it comes down over KwaZulu-Natal and lands up somewhere in the Indian Ocean, but a lot of it precipitates along the way. And one of the suspicions about the high levels of mercury in the Ananda Dam is that one of the possible sources is actually the high-fire power stations. The other source is rather more obvious, and that's the Thor mercury recycling facility up at Cato Ridge. A lot of those pollutants like mercury are not actually mentioned by ESKOM anyway, And one of the key pollutants that they don't mention is methane, of which they emit rather a lot, more than the rest of the country put combined, I think. Along with this is coal. Humongous amounts of coal being burnt, and should this capacity be built, then by 2018 we will need 40 additional mines. Now about five of those mines are for additional exports. Part of our great carbon saving plans is to export as much coal as we possibly can. Primarily, we've been exporting it to Europe. Our big export destinations now are China. Well, our big growth markets are China, which I think this year is our biggest export destination, and India, where they're also cooperating with our carbon plans by building a whole bunch of coal-fired power stations.
Again, this is David Howes on South Africa's coal-fired power industry that looks ready to receive a $3.75 billion infusion of money from the World Bank. David presented at a recent international seminar based at the Center for Civil Society at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, Durban. Following David, we'll hear from community organizers who are mobilizing to protest against this financial boondoggle that simply increases South Africa's already heavy carbon footprint. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, dedicated to bringing these pressing issues to Raising Sand Radio each week. All of our shows are downloadable at raisingsandradio.org. If you want to get in touch with me, you can do so via susan@raisingsandradio.org. David Howes goes on now to talk about the impacts of coal mining.
The impacts of coal mining are absolutely stupendous. A major impact on water. There's also an impact on air, by the way, because a lot of these particularly open-cast mines have a habit of spontaneously combusting. A phrase that I love, but spontaneous combustion, and there's a hell of a lot of coal that goes up by spontaneous combustion. And of course, because it's in the open, it simply goes up into the atmosphere. There's no mitigation of it whatsoever. The other major impact is on water. Mining has the effect of bringing rock into contact with oxygen and immobilizes sulfates in that rock, which then produces something called acid mine drainage. The rivers out of what used to be called Witbank, it's now called Emlatsheni, are already pretty much ruined. And my colleague Victor Munich went out and looked around there, and he said, that stream looks like it's been snowed on. The sulfates are so thick on that stream. Now this is quite a densely populated area, right? The most advanced part of the new build program was the return to service of three old coal-fired power plants that were mothballed back in the 90s because Eskom overbuilt during the 80s. The return to service of those things has driven a major increase in the coal demand in Mpumalanga, and a lot of that demand has been supplied or is intended to be supplied from small coal mines which are opening up in the Mpumalanga Lake District. This area has not previously been mined, and some of that coal is going for export or is intended for export, but the rest of it is for the Eskom stations. That area is at the source of three major river systems, the Vaal, the Komati, and the Esutu. This is simply tragic. 5 years after that starts, the acid mine drainage will start. They do not have the bucks to put in the big plants that Anglo-American Billitons, for example, are putting in Witbank. They're small, usually independent miners, and those coal mines are only going to last for 5 or 6 years before they're played out. So you need to go and start a new coal mine. It is simply catastrophic. In the area of Medupi, it seems to be a little bit more ambiguous. I'm not quite sure exactly how that's going to work. They're exploring different techniques. I'm not sure whether those are open cast mines or underground mines that they're going to use. I think that the mine that supplies Matimba, which is an already existing power station in that area, is supplied by an underground mine. You still get problems with acid mine drainage. Lephalale is dry. The water supply to the mines, the water supply to the power stations themselves is going to be a bit of a challenge. for the Department of Water Affairs, which assures us that the water is going to be there, but hasn't actually completed the feasibility studies. That includes for the scrubbers. Scrubbers are water consumptive. They are better than not having scrubbers, but once you scrub the sulfur out, well, you've got to do something with the sulfur. So it doesn't go up, but it comes down instead. That's got to go somewhere. In the meantime, the scrubbers are water intensive. Whether when we get to 2018, by which time the scrubbers are supposed to be retrofitted, there's going to be enough water for those plants is a moot question. We might be told in 2018, and I suspect that it's probably quite likely, that it's simply not feasible. In Botswana, there's another power station. It's about half the size of Medupi. It is to be built by CIC, a Canadian company, who are kind of in partnership with the Botswana utility. They haven't got to go ahead to build it yet. They are awaiting the Eskom contracts. Eskom is yet to actually conclude one of those contracts. But you have a combination now of the proposals of the existing Matimba power plant, Medupi power plant, where construction has started, and the CIC power plant on the other side of the border, all clustered in the same area, all drawing off the same coal field. Pretty soon, I reckon, we'll have turned the Lephalale area into the equivalent of Witbank. Eskom does have a climate change policy. It's not very convincing. It depends on diversification. Primarily, they relied on nukes, but they had a little bit of renewable energy in there. Energy efficiency is the next big one, but basically energy efficiency ends up in an expanded energy system, and the underlying reasons for that aren't addressed. The underlying reason for that is that the savings of energy are returned to capital, not to the energy system. They have a research and innovation policy, and is using the carbon market. Convinces nobody apart from the World Bank, Eskom, and Sasol, and other major utilities who've done rather well out of it, and indeed increased their carbon emissions.
There was David Howers, author of the recent report, The World Bank and Eskom, Banking on Climate Destruction. Again, this report is free to download from Groundwork's website, groundwork.co.za.
Children of the world, you have the right to sing and dance, run and play, let your dreams take flight.
Sarah Thompson and Is It for Freedom? As we move to Professor Patrick Bond, who moderated the event and is director of the Center for Civil Society at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, Durban. You're listening to Stanford University's Raising Sand Radio on FM 90.1. We also stream live from 2 to 3 Pacific Time in California. You can go to our website, raisingsandradio.org, for streaming coordinates and to download any of our other shows. Email me at susan@raisingsandradio.org. And today we're listening to a recent international online discussion. Here is Director Professor Patrick Bond, who moderated the event held at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, Durban's Center for Civil Society.
Our architecture of this is to quickly go through all these stats and data and now go to community resistance strategies that are local in nature. And then after Des, I'll ask Trevor to think back to particularly times a decade ago when the World Bank was under pressure, and the pressure point on the World Bank is a loan that we've been hearing about, $3.7 billion. I've then also been scanning around the world a bit, and I'll finish with that before. Des Desart is the South Durban Community Environmental Alliance main director, campaigner, troublemaker.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks to David. I mean, he's refreshed our memory. Eskom and the major mining corporations, including the major oil corporations in that area, externalized the costs. So poor black communities paid the price of the poor health that they experience. And despite the cost that they pay and the burden that's impacted upon them, they do not benefit the electricity that is provided by these power stations. None of those black communities in Middelburg, in Sasolburg, in Zamdela, on the Highveld, benefit out of that electricity that is generated. And yet, we all pay the cost. We all pay the price in this country. In 2008, Eskom, well, previous to that, the Mbeki regime in South Africa, together with Eskom, had concocted the whole idea to develop the pebble bed modular reactor to create energy in this country through that process. And many of us in this country were dismayed after hearing many stories of poor communities living in Pelindaba, as well as in the Northern Cape, where the uranium dump sites are, and the impact it had on the agriculture, on the rivers, and on the marine life. And we also know that through the uranium mining in this country, the impact it has had on poor communities and the effect it has had. So we campaigned, and in 2008, a huge public euphoria grew out of this campaign against the pebble bed modular, and many people in this country rejected it outright and said to the government, a new energy policy needs to be developed together with the people of this country. However, Eskom had a lot of lobbying power, and together they had people within the nuclear energy sector that was pushing this whole idea of nuclear energy. We hope that we can bury it once and for all. In the state of the president's address last night, where they are looking at alternative energies and it might come back in another form. To Eskom now, one of the issues by the president last night was that there has to be a private energy sector. And that is another serious concern if carte blanches are given to privatize the energy sector in this country, and where captains of industry are brought on board. It means that the access to poor communities will be denied completely, and there will be more problems we're experiencing. The reason why we're really campaigning around this whole issue of Eskom and its impact on the ground environmentally is that, and I know David has covered all of it, but I just want to cover the tariff itself. Prior to the Eskom going on this issue of trying to get more money in to develop more coal-fired power stations to develop energy, we've already seen the high cost of electricity. In Durban alone, we've had something like about 14 to 20,000 households in Durban having the electricity cut off on a monthly basis. And I know in other parts of the country, there's been the same amount of people. And particularly in poor communities, we see that with the high cost of energy, already people are bearing the brunt. We know for a fact, as a fence line neighbor of the major uses of energy, like the paper malls, the oil refineries, the aluminium smelters, we know that we are paying seven times more as ordinary residents in this country for people who make huge amounts of profit that is exported to Europe and to New York and to Australia. And the question is that if our people who are already in abject poverty, who are living below the breadline, who are living on state grants, are finding it so difficult to pay for electricity that the electricity is being cut off, why should we continue on this program and this plan and this model that has failed poor people in this country? We're in the majority. So our aim was to stand up and defend those that are marginalized, those that are vulnerable, the majority of the people of this country who feel that the economic model of this country is not going down to benefit them at all. So the question is that who benefits out of this program of Eskom? And we see that that is not the ordinary people in this country. That is not the masses of the 48 million of people in this country that will benefit out of this. It's a few people, the top echelons of society, but also the top CEOs and governments who have a major stake in it. We know that the ANC, who is the ruling party in this country, has got a huge stake in this whole issue of the further development of the coal-fired power stations that David has mentioned. And it's all profit, and no wonder that they have gone down this road to have these increases, which will burden people for the next 3 years, of over 105%. That's only the cost that we're aware of. We're not aware of the hidden costs that will be added to it. Result when the municipality comes through in July every year. We know that there's already gazetted in the local municipality two of the tariff increases in preparations for July the 1st. We're not even talking about the other costs that is added to the administrative costs when your electricity is cut off. When you add up all that, there is no way that ordinary unemployed poor people, those earning below the breadline, those that are earning, even ordinary workers in companies, can afford to pay for this tariff. And there's a double dose, what I call a double dose. Not only do they pay for the cost of electricity, but they also pay for the health effects of these energy producers. And that is not factored into this whole thing. And this is where the government has failed us drastically, in the sense that it only looks at profit, and it looks at, can this this paddle state make more money, produce more energy, and why should we be paying for these huge multinational corporations that have been brought through, that have been exported from the first world through to the third world, like where we are in South Africa. We see all these huge aluminium smelters, most of the paper corporations, most of their production is coming through to South Africa, where we are paying the electricity costs for these profit makers. And that is why we've had a public program of rolling mass action in Durban. We've started last year in November. In January on the 18th, we went to where the National Energy Regulator in Durban came down to Durban and had public hearings, and we had to mobilize. The government, together with the industry, don't want to mobilize the communities to come to these hearings. In fact, they have limited hearings, less participation by the public, because they're scared of the public raising their voices. What has happened is that they took organizations like ourselves to mobilize this entire province to come to the hearings so that people can raise their voices in those hearings. We don't know how successful that has been, but we have not taken our gas off the pedal, because we certainly believe that we must continue this rolling mass action, this year of action. And on the 16th, on Tuesday, we will be at the Eskom offices, and we're hoping that comrades are going to join us in Cape Town and in Joburg as well, and to get this Eskom plan and application rejected completely. We believe that entire application must be rejected, and not just parts of it. We want there must be a proper energy plan developed by the people of South Africa, for the people of South Africa, and not by certain individuals with self-interest. We want the people of South Africa to be involved in developing a new plan that will take cognizance of the environment, that will take cognizance of poverty, that will take cognizance of equity, of how we should be living here in this country. So that will be the start of it. We do go back to the ICC on the 22nd of February, where the energy profit makers will all be gathering, and we want to go there and to challenge them and take them on, and also to tell them in no uncertain terms what ordinary people are saying about them, and to say to them that this road is leading to a cul-de-sac. We're aiming to stand up and fight in this country. We're aiming to really take it to every walks of life. And these CEOs need to realize that they're not going to be protected, because they are the ones that are creating the problems that we are experiencing in this country at the expense of our families and our children, and at the expense of our generations that are coming. So we're not prepared to accept their ideology, which has failed and it's only benefit them and no one else. So this is a year where we are aiming to really put our bodies on the line so that other people can benefit.
Des Dessart of South Durban Community Environmental Alliance, a terrifically active group of communities fighting back against enormous odds to regain control of their neighborhoods from polluting industries. The South Durban Community Environmental Alliance is a non-governmental coalition of community and environmental organizations launched in November 1995. Its members struggle together to bring higher environmental standards to the industries and communities that coexist in South Durban. South Durban Community Environmental Alliance seeks a more sustainable South Durban and eThekwini, which is the municipality of that area, and ensure the health and well-being of the human and natural environment. It has South Durban Community Environmental Alliance has many affiliates: the Airport Farmers, the Civics, Osterville Clinic Communities, the Bluff Ridge Conservancy, Catholic Church, Professor Patrick Bond from the Center for Civil Society, Professor Diane Scott, also at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. Anyway, you can reach the South Durban Community Environmental Alliance through sdcea.co.za and find out more about what is going on there. And you're listening to Raising Sand Radio on Stanford University's KZSU FM 90.1. I'm Susan Gallimore, bringing a seminar conducted out of the Center for Civil Society. Professor Patrick Bond is director and organizer of the event and introduces the next speaker. You heard and will hear more references to recent hearings conducted around the country by the National Energy Regulator of South Africa, also known as NERSA, and they made these meetings in different communities to justify to or convince citizens that a 35% increase in electricity rates for each of the next 3 years is unavoidable. Raising Sand Radio was at the Durban hearings, and we aired that show a couple of weeks ago, and you can go to the website raisingsandradio.org to listen to it. While you're on that site, note that you can download any of our shows. And we're heading into our fourth year of being on air, so you'll find an assortment of shows on topics that address our world.
Trevor is the chair of the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee, and he's finishing his master's degree with us. And he was also instrumental in the year 2000, April 15th, I believe, in launching the World Bank bonds boycott. So there's a long history that goes back, I guess, 1999, when you were the chair of the ANC in Soweto and were fired because of the opposition to privatization, and then started organizing around electricity. So take it away.
Yeah, it's amazing that from the point of view, our organization, the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee, because Eskom, in a way, is our favorite enemy. You know, Eskom provides electricity in working-class townships, and we have to deal with Eskom's antics. And in fact, the organization was formed exactly as a response, a struggle against Eskom's ways. But it was amazing during the recent NERSA hearings, because suddenly, you know, Eskom was everyone's enemy, you know, across the political spectrum, even bosses, middle class, everyone just hates Eskom and can see there's something wrong with the way they are handling energy in South Africa. Okay, we are not going to say I told you so, but after 10 years fighting against Eskom, the organization has developed new concerns and is more worried about arriving at lasting solutions. Because on the one hand, we formed our organization to secure access to energy. But as we fought, we learned a few things. For example, we learned that behind the cutoffs, robbing the poor of access to clean energy, was the policy of privatization. Which the ANC government, in fact, they wanted to privatize Eskom at that time. Yeah, and then behind or together with the privatization policy was the government's macroeconomic policy gear, which basically can be described as a neoliberal economic policy. You know, it promotes what the good comrade was talking about, trickle-down development model. You know, make the rich richer, and then some will drop down and the poor. So that's what we learned in fighting for our right to access energy. And then behind gear, we found now the usual culprit, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization. In the decade, we call it the unholy trinity, because the World Bank, IMF, WTO, they represent what is wrong with the world. Let's take Africa. Many countries in Africa never benefited from democracy, national liberation, because immediately a kind of neo-colonialism took over, a kind of recolonization of Africa, of the broader third world, using other means. And at the center of this recolonization was the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO, you know, with the neoliberal trickle-down economics. which our government embraced and which on the ground was felt as an attack on our right to electricity, an attack on our right to basic services such as water, housing. So this fight goes back many years, but where are we today? The enemy is still there. Okay, there have been some nice lessons from the point of view of the struggle. For example, with the recent economic crisis, it became clear that the whole story about governments must not intervene in the economy is just hogwash, because suddenly billions of dollars were given, handed over to the bosses. So the power of that argument has disappeared. You know, not just for, you know, the guys writing books, for parliamentarians, but for ordinary people. They can see that when necessary, capitalist governments do move in and intervene in favor of, unfortunately, you know, the richer part of the of society. So that's one lesson we've got as we face the same old enemy. The other lesson is that if you look at the protest actions going on, it's clear for many ordinary working class people, you know, because when they came with their privatization, their policy of cost recovery, you must pay for the electricity you consume. And then they moved away from demanding a flat rate, you know, now you have to pay according to how much. You know, it was always, you only get what you pay for. There is nothing for mahala. This was the story. The ANC government even had a special campaign, Masakane. Let's build together, pay for your services. Now, after 14 years, 15 years, 20 years, people are realizing, no, it's not true that you only get what you pay for. You only get what you fight for. That's why the country is up in flames. People are realizing, people tell you, hey, we want Zuma here. Let's burn tires, set up barricades, maybe burn one mayor's house, one councillor, and then these politicians are going to come down and listen and take, you know, pay some attention to your problems. So this is the situation South Africa is in today. And I think that as we face Eskom now, especially this question of a loan to Eskom, okay, we have lost some ground, I think, in terms of arguments against the World Bank. You know, remember the World Social Forum was kind of a counter to the World Economic Forum. Yeah, yeah. But so there was a time when the ANC government, when the broader left, including the alliance in South Africa, you know, they thought a bit about the World Bank. Remember the work of Ben Turok, you know, we must keep the World Bank at a distance, we don't want to go the same route as Africa. And those arguments, in a way, have disappeared, because now South Africa wants to go to the World Economic Forum to prove that they are the new emerging economy down south, ready to cooperate and follow, in a way, capitalist, neoliberal, pro-rich policies to the letter. So I think we've lost some ground there, in the sense that, you know, even as the masses realize the lies of neoliberalism, our leaders are stuck. And in fact, they want to move up in that pecking order. You know, it's a chance for South Africa. It's a chance for Eskom to put back all the old arguments, you know, because our rulers, you know, have bought into that. But in any case, moving forward, I think there is enough suspicion about the motives of Eskom, about the motives of the government in South Africa, about the motives of the capitalist class in South Africa for us to move forward. You know, we've got scandals around bread price fixing, scandals around mobile telephone rates, you know, so I think we stand a good chance, you know, if we want a campaign against this particular loan from the World Bank to Eskom. We have to, you know, revisit all the old arguments, connect with the new situation, and I'm sure, you know, we can move forward. Yeah, thank you.
There was Trevor, chair of the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee, who was also involved in the World Bank bonds boycott. We'll end with Professor Patrick Bond, who is the director of the Center for Civil Society and also convener of this online seminar. We'll talk further with Patrick Bond in a future show and learn more about the center and its work. Meanwhile, look for the center online by searching for the Center for Civil Society. It is a gem of active learning and is the place where community activists and ordinary people interact directly with academia and create a confluence of generative ideas from the grassroots to, as we call it, the ivory tower.
I'll very, very quickly say that the idea of trying to stop this loan to ESCOM came partly because of this extremely good report that David put together, but also because there's a conjunction in which the World Bank is very vulnerable. And there are two reasons. It needs to raise $250 billion in capital to continue its growth and have reserves ready to make loans. And they're trying to do that. They do that every so often, the recapitalization, roughly every decade. This is a very big one. And they have a very unpopular president, Robert Zoellick, who doesn't have a constituency. His constituency, of course, was the petro-military complex. He was the kind of creature of the Bush regime who had to replace Paul Wolfowitz after the nepotism scandal in 2007. And so his term, he's a lame duck, he won't be reappointed. There's gossip indeed that the next World Bank president might be our own Trevor Manuel or Lula, the president of Brazil. So it's a very fluid situation, but Zoellick feels he has to raise some money. And so he's going to the spring meetings. Hopefully he thinks he can have general permission from his member groups to raise $250 billion. Now, the second reason that the bank is vulnerable, so that we feel we can use this as a pressure point against ESCOM, is that they're also trying to become the green bank by being the main climate funder. And their funds include the financing of renewable energy, but also they're the funder of the carbon markets through the Prototype Carbon Fund and their promotion of the clean development mechanism. We witnessed in a field trip just 2 days ago here when we went out to the Bisasa Road landfill, the biggest in Africa, and saw the way that they're trying to do methane to electricity, basically in order to keep that dump, the racist dump, the one that put in the black neighborhoods, going for another number of years. So these are the sorts of things that make us very angry about the way the World Bank's handled the climate, because it's the biggest fossil fuel investment portfolio, and yet it's trying to pretend that it's greening so that it can take all these new funds that, say, Hillary Clinton promised $100 billion a year from the north to the south, and the World Bank, of course, wants to be the middleman and take a good chunk of profit. So what we've found is that in Washington, an interesting group, sometimes people we don't agree with a lot, people at the Sierra Club or places, institutions that don't necessarily line up on the red-green side of things. Sierra Club I mentioned because there's been some controversies in California. Sierra Club has had such extremely good work underway with the fighting against coal plants in the U.S. that I have to just as much balance by saying we have a lot to learn from them. Another is Greenpeace International. I think some of us remember that going into Copenhagen, Greenpeace said that South Africa was going to be the star. In fact, was the star of Copenhagen for making a commitment to reduce emissions from business as usual rates by 34% by 2020. And it turned out, as EarthLife showed, that this was a scam, that there was no chance of getting to business as usual in any case. The issue of ESCOM's loan to ESCOM in the international circuits that they're working in. And that's what we've been able, I think, David, Tristan Taylor out of EarthLife and Bobby Peake in Groundwork discussing this recently with a number of colleagues in Washington, to actually say, well, wait, you guys who are trying to stop the World Bank from being as dirty as they are, because these are Washington groups that have the World Bank in their sights, you actually have to listen to the local campaigning processes to make sure that the campaign to end ESCOM's coal-fired plant strategies and bring the prices down, crucially requiring something I think we haven't really mentioned, which is to turn off the power to the aluminium smelters. If we could turn off the power to the big smelters where a large chunk of electricity goes, and the big industries, if you put them all together, are over 40%, whereas individual consumers are only 17%. Of electricity consumption. And the fact is they get the cheapest electricity in the world because they set up deals at the end of apartheid multi-decade deals to give them very, very cheap electricity that's tied to the price of aluminium. So as we saw with aluminium crashing last year and the currency crashing, Eskom then had bet on the wrong side and lost 12 billion rand just in those bets. So they're doing a lot of damage, and there's only about 900 jobs in the major smelters in Richards Bay. And the National Union of Metalworkers, we're hoping, will agree that those jobs could be, in a just transition, turned into jobs building hot water heaters, passive solar hot water heaters, and there'd be many, many more jobs that way than there are in the smelters. And that's the configuration. It's not yet fully in place, to be sure. But certainly it looks like, driven from campaigning groups, and particularly DES has been the key leader in making sure that activists are honing in on Eskom and using the general anger about Eskom to address both the price increase and the climate damage. It's an incredible red-green combination of thinking locally and acting locally, but thinking globally and acting globally too, that SETSI has really set us the stage for. So why do we think we can then pressure the World Bank? Not only do we have these interesting allies, we have to watch them quite carefully to be sure, but also the World Bank was under pressure once before, and Trevor and the late Dennis Brutus were two of the key people who inaugurated a campaign called the World Bank Bonds Boycott, and we now call it generally the World Bank Boycott. And as we ratchet up this pressure, and we let everyone know on Tuesday that the World Bank is part of the enemy in this and that they're going to be subject to part of this critique, we then need to have more tools and weapons against the World Bank. And it may well be time then for us to say, well, just like apartheid, when in the United States, in Europe, people didn't invest in companies that were making profits from the system. They disinvested in that way, or they divested, and they were trying to encourage disinvestment. Well, the World Bank is the brain of global apartheid, and so to divest from the World Bank bonds that they sell to institutional investors, that's where they get 80% of the funds that they lend onwards, like pension funds and municipal funds and church funds and endowments for universities, municipal funds, all these different funds. Pressure can be put on those funds to not buy World Bank bonds and to shrink the market and to lower the credit rating of the World Bank. Sounds a little idealistic, but believe it or not, because Dennis Brutus visited the biggest pension fund in the world, TIAA-CREF, on three occasions, they eventually did sell their World Bank bonds and a whole slew of social corporate responsibility funds, like the Calvert Group, said, we will never buy a World Bank bond again. And big universities and especially big cities, San Francisco, Oakland, Berkeley, Cambridge, Massachusetts, Milwaukee, Boulder, Colorado, they all agreed that they wouldn't hold any World Bank bonds as the campaigning got up and running. Well, the campaigning fizzled out in about 2003. The reason was the main group that we were working with, the Center for Economic Justice, lost funding, and so the campaign was then passed to 50 years is enough, and they lost funding. So we had just saw the sort of downturn in the global justice movement organizing that meant the World Bank bonds boycott kind of fell into disuse. I think it may well be time on the 10th anniversary of its launch on April 15, 2000, now maybe in April 2010, to think about bringing it back. And the catalyst for that would be if the World Bank goes ahead with a loan. And that brings us to a very final point, which is the most bizarre ally of all, a man called Tim Geithner. Tim Geithner, who is U.S. Treasury Secretary, who's one of the sort of crony capitalists who bailed out to the tune many trillions. I've heard figures from reliable sources of about $13 trillion of U.S. taxpayer and Federal Reserve funding that went into bailing out Wall Street. And, of course, Barack Obama's part and parcel of this because he gets his campaign contributions from those same guys. So he appointed as his main economic advisor Larry Summers. I'm sure I don't have to mention Larry Summers here to get a snicker. Now, this is a weird ally, right? But believe it or not, the U.S. Treasury's come down already against the World Bank on its lending for coal-fired power plants. And the World Bank has had a pass, an abstention, for a vote on this Eskom loan, but the loan was via the African Development Bank. We're not really too sure of the whole logic behind them simply abstaining, because they actually do have a policy of voting against these loans. If the U.S. Treasury, with 17% ownership of the World Bank, votes against the loan to Eskom, then there will not be a loan to Eskom. They have a veto power with 15%. That's one of the reasons we hate the World Bank, isn't it, that the U.S. can veto anything at once with just 15%. So it's a little contradictory at first blush for us to be saying, oh, well, we want that. So what we've had to say, finally, is that we not only want the U.S. Treasury and the South African Treasury and every other treasury to use its power as executive directors. The South Africans don't have one. There's a man, I believe, from Liberia who is the Anglophone African director of the World Bank, and we've already started communication with him to say, vote no on this loan. But what we want is all the countries to say, vote no. But we are sure that that won't happen. In fact, the South executive directors to the World Bank have already written a letter to the U.S. Treasury saying, to hell with you, we're all voting yes for this, and we want to have a yes vote on all coal-fired power plant loans. And it's outside the World Bank's mandate to think about climate. They actually have a letter saying this kind of nonsense. This is the Southern Compradors, and they just want more loans. So this is quite a tricky situation. So to say, well, how do we get around the weird politics that I'm describing, where U.S. Treasury may be our ally? Sure, we're saying to all the countries, don't vote for the World Bank loan, but we're also saying something else to the U.S. The U.S. Treasury must not fund new coal-fired plants in the United States. And luckily, we have the Sierra Club, which has these great lawyers who've sued every single coal-fired power plant that's been proposed and stopped every single one. It's amazing. Luckily, we've got in West Virginia activists, a guy called Mike Rozelle. He's with one of the many wonderful grassroots groups in West Virginia. What do they not like? Blowing up mountains to get coal, mountaintop removals, and there's a fantastic campaign of squatting in trees and civil disobedience. And thirdly, we love the campaigning that goes on across the U.S. to keep the oil in the soil and leave the coal in the hole, where they do direct action against the corporations, like Chevron in California. So what I think we're saying in our major statement that comes out on Tuesday is that while the U.S. Treasury shouldn't approve money for the World Bank to lend to Eskom to build more coal-fired power plants to give the cheapest electricity in the world to the biggest companies in the world who export their profits to London and Melbourne and do a lot of other damage while raising the prices for poor people. So that's quite a lot of problems. We don't want the U.S. Treasury to support that, nor do we want the U.S. Treasury to support any kind of funding for subsidized fossil fuels. And they do a huge amount of fossil fuel subsidies there.
Haunted by Waters, and Like the Dust, to bring home the message shared today by final speaker and convener of this event, Professor Patrick Bond, director of the Center for Civil Society based at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, Durban. And that is our show for today. As usual, all views and opinions are those of the host and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. Tune in again next week to listen live on Pacific Time, Monday from 2 to 3 at Stanford University's KZSU FM 90.1. Go to our website, raisingsandradio.org, to listen to the internet streaming or find the coordinates for the streaming feature on the website, raisingsandradio.org. You can also simply download this or any other show and listen at your convenience, also from that website. Email me at susan@raisingsandradio.org. to comment on our shows or suggest topics for future shows. Let's go out with Haunted by Waters and Like the Dust.